Colin's Story, Episode 2, Joining Up.
So I decided at the age of 16 that I would go and join the Territorial Army, know the regulars. I had in my childhood been in the Army Cadets at one stage, so I had a sort of a wee bit of an insight as a child into the sort of forces. So at 17 or thereabouts, I joined the Territorial Army. I wasn't too concerned greatly at that point about where I was going, though, because I still lived at home and things like that. I wasn't enclosed with other soldiers for any great lengths of time. So I went and I joined the TA, and looking back on that, the TA at that time, I'm sure it's different today, but at that time, it was more a sociable thing, really, as opposed to a military thing. There was always lots of drinking, lots of fun, and you could go a couple of nights a week. There was a bar after you'd done what you were doing in that night, and you would just get pissed. So you would, and then you'd get away the odd weekend here and there, and even that at the weekends was more sociable than it was in military. That's how I seen it, and most people did. You got a bounty every year, a lump sum every year, and it was good pocket money. So it was. So that's what I'd done, and the more I was in the TA, the more I was getting involved with it, and I was starting to enjoy it. So I thought to myself, it would maybe be a good time to seriously think about going into the regular army. Still, I was a bit apprehensive, really, overall, because, again, in my sexuality, this is going to be different, Colin. This isn't the TA. You're going to be confined in barracks, and you're going to be there on a regular basis. You're not going to get home whenever you just feel like saying, I'm going home. You don't know where in the world you're going to be, for a start. So I was apprehensive about it, but I thought that I would go. And what I did say to myself was, what a place to go when you're hiding a secret. Of all places, you want to go to the army. And I often said that to myself. But I also said to myself that, well, I'm as good as, or I would be as good as any soldier. Irrelevant, my sexual orientation. So that really spurred me on, because I looked at myself as being no different from any other soldier. And I still maintain that today. It doesn't matter. So that's what I've done. But with a difference, because an opportunity came up to me whilst I was in the Territorial Army that I could go to any regiment of my choice, and it would only be for a year only. It would be a full-time attachment to any battalion that I wanted to go to. So that intrigued me, and I was like, well, that's quite good, this is, because that means after a year I can come back out then, after a year. So I went on what they call a short-term engagement, and I joined the Argyll 1st Battalion, the Argyll and Southern Highlanders, which are an infantry Scottish regiment. And for day one, I'd done my training in Glencore's barracks in Edinburgh, and it was an 18-week training course before you got attached to your unit. But because I had been in the TA, I'd already known quite a lot of stuff. So I didn't have to do 18 weeks training. I got fast forwarded when I was at Glencore's barracks, and I ended up doing 10 weeks. So I arrived at my battalion, who at that time were based in Borland Barracks in Catterick, and I went there, and I got hassle for day one, because people looked upon me as being a TA soldier. I wasn't a regular soldier. They had signed up, they had signed the dotted line, and some of them were stuck with that. Whereas there's me going in there and for a year only. So people took a dislike, not everyone, people took a dislike to me almost for day one because I was only in for a year, whereas they were in for maybe 3, 6, whatever many years. So I did get a bit of jip for that, but that was really too worrying for me. That was in 1979, late 1979. We got called up on an emergency tour to Hong Kong. At the time, Hong Kong was under British rule. So there was that many illegal immigrants coming across from China into Hong Kong that the British government decided that they would send in a battalion to patrol the new territories in Hong Kong, which was the border between China and Hong Kong. So that was an emergency tour, as I said. We patrolled the borders, mainly nighttime work, to catch illegal immigrants coming across the border. And that was our job for 6 months, which was quite exciting, but it was quite sad as well, when there was a woman and children there, and we were having to stop, and our job was to detain them, and then to hand them over to the Royal Hong Kong Police, who in turn would put them into detention. And then the next day, or whenever, a few days, they would be sent back on a train back into China. And that's what happened. And a lot, because it's a communist country, a lot of these people who got caught in Hong Kong, when they went back, they were treated horrendously because they had rejected China. So a lot of them went into hard labour camps and things like that. So the job was quite a difficult job to do, especially when you had a mother and her. In one instance that I can always remember, it was a mother and her two daughters who we had caught on the border, and the kids were screaming. I mean, if you can imagine, it was pitch black, and all these soldiers were with guns and things like that and detaining them, and children were really crying, and as the mother was. And the mother, she had a gold filling, and she was wanting us to take the gold filling out her mouth, to give us the gold filling, to let them go. But that never happened. We never done that, and they were detained. Because, like any job, you're there to do a job. Sometimes you've got to put your emotions, your feelings aside. So that was me in Hong Kong. This is where my troubles, I suppose, really started in the army, because I was compromised about my sexuality one night in a guard room. I never done it intentionally. I'd said something, or a person asked me a question. It was something along those lines, and it became quite apparent to this other person that I was gay. Girlfriends were spoken about, and I can remember I was nervous and I was given the wrong kind of answers, which made any half-decent, intelligent person say to themselves, there's something right about him. And wee rumours were sort of going about at this point, which I had known about. So that was me getting stressed in the first under a year. Been in there, girls. But I continued to plod on. I still wasn't going to tell anyone. They could think what they wanted, was my attitude, and I just soldiered on. And I'd just done exactly the same job as what they'd done. After Catterick, we went to Northern Ireland for 2 years. It used to be 4 month and 18 month tours that the British Army served in Northern Ireland. But in 1980, the government changed that from 6 month to 2 year tours in Northern Ireland. So we were the first regiment ever to go to Northern Ireland for 2 years. And so we arrived in Northern Ireland, and we were based in Ballykelly, in between Londonderry and Kilrain, or Limavady. It was just in the middle, those two places. It was an old Army Air Force airfield. That's where we were actually based, but we worked throughout the whole province. That was just our base. So we would go out for a week at a time to a certain place, South Armagh, or whatever the case may be, and we'd maybe spend a week there. then we'd come back to base, and that's how we worked it for the 2 years that we were there. Because this was all playing in my mind about the sexuality thing, it was that was always niggling away at me, and the more I heard rumours, the more stressed that I got, and I became really a bit of a handful. I got into quite a lot of trouble in Northern Ireland. I was quite prone to being in the cells for the weekends and that. But nobody, again, really knew deep down. There was just rumours, they never knew, but I knew. There were a lot of frightening moments in Northern Ireland, but the most important thing for me was I was still doing my job. I was still sticking in there. So about 6 months into the tour in Northern Ireland, it was approaching my year where my time with the regular army would be coming to an end. But again, because I was enjoying it, and although I was getting into some trouble, I was still confident that I could carry this through and sign on a regular basis. And that's what I did do. I signed on for 3 years, not as an attachment anymore, as a regular soldier. And I signed on for 3 years. And that 3 years came and it went. And I decided to sign on for a further 3 years. So that would be like 6 years in total. So I signed on for a further 3 years whilst I was still in Northern Ireland. And I was still young, and I can always remember about Northern Ireland. It was a place called Dungannon. And I remember, as still a lad, for the very first time in my life, I was going onto the streets of Northern Ireland with a gun. And I can remember the very first time, as I say, and I was proud, but I was scared at the same time to know that I had this power in me that I could come into conflict and I could kill someone. And I think that's when it kind of hit home to me what my job entailed. And it made me even stronger knowing that I was gay, that I could do the same as them. You know what I mean? And that's exactly what I've done. And there's so many different stories of losing people and troubles that we came upon. And we were all young men. We were all around about that age, apart from senior NCOs. You know, we were all 19, 18, 19, 20, early 20s, all that kind of age, just young men. But I got through Northern Ireland, and my next posting would be to Cyprus, which was in 1982. We got posted to Cyprus, and well, we all thought, this is great. This is great. We're going to sun, sea, drink, things like that. So it was quite exciting after doing 2 years in Northern Ireland to go to a country like that. And Cyprus was quite good. And I mean, if you weren't on duty, then you'd finish at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. That'd be you until next day. And when I was in Cyprus, the sexual abuse, verbal, was getting worse, especially with senior NCOs. And this is when it really hit me, and I was angry. I remember I was angry. And they gave me a nickname. I'll always remember that nickname. And if the person who gave me that nickname is sitting listening to me just now, you know who I'm talking about. And you gave me that nickname, Gay Lord. Gay Lord. What a name would be called in front of other soldiers, it was so embarrassing. It really, really was. It was so embarrassing that, right, Gaylord, it's your turn, right, Gaylord. Oh, I feel it smashing his head in. In fact, not so long ago, about a year ago, I came across him on the internet and I sent him a message. And I said to him on the message, "Do you remember me? Gaylord, you must remember me." Did I ever get a reply? No. Because he knew him and his sidekick caused me stress, and again, suicidal thoughts were coming into my head. It was a nightmare. I was embarrassed, I was ashamed. Well, not so much ashamed, but like being ashamed, if you know what I mean. I didn't know what to do, and again, I was getting into trouble, even in Cyprus, and it wasn't anything new for me to be in the jail. But I knew it was all coming. This was all coming to an end. This had to finish somewhere. There had to be an end to this. But I wasn't willing to, at that point, I wasn't willing to fulfil my 6 years. I decided mentally I couldn't cope with this anymore. I'd had enough. I never ran away from the army, and I'll still stand by that to the day I die. I ran away from what was happening to me and how it affected my life, how it affected me being a soldier, as I said earlier, run like anyone else. So my head was totally wasted. I drank more, I got into trouble more, but again, nobody knew, apart from these rumours and things like that. I hadn't officially come out because it was against the law, wasn't it? If I'd have come out as being gay, then, well, I'd have got charged, I'd have got to jail, I'd have been kicked out. I think that's exactly what would have happened. And things were building up and building up. And in 1983, there was this guy who I got friendly with, and he kept saying to me, "Come on, we'll go absent." Because he sort of had an incline what was going on in my life. Because sometimes I would tell him, because I kind of trusted him. He never knew 100% though. But if he'd have been saying the same things to me, I'd have picked up that that's what it would have been. And he kept saying to me, "Hey, come on, we'll go." "Hey, well." And I was like, "Well," I says, "that's a bit of an impossibility." I says, "Because," I says, "we're stuck here in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea." I says, "The army are holding their passports." I says, "It's an island." I says, "Where can we go?" I says, "We can't go anywhere." And he kept bringing this up quite regular. And I remember one night we were out of the RAFE and we were drunk. Went back to barracks and fell asleep. And I remember the next morning, before all the rest of the troops got up out of bed, this guy who I'm talking about came into my room and says, "Come on, let's just do it, let's just do it." And I just jumped up out of drunken sleep. And I was grabbing what I could. I never grabbed any clothes. I put on civvies. Grabbed cleaning stuff. The likes of shampoo and soap and toothpaste and things like that. No, even another T-shirt. And away we went, out of Episcopi Garrison in Cyprus, and we headed for the docks in Limassol. And we managed to get into the docks, and I was sending him on boats. We weren't caring where in the world that we were going to. We weren't interested. We were just wanting to get off the island of Cyprus. But because we never had any passports, he kept coming off each boat and saying to me, "They're not taking us. No passports," which is understandable, eh? But he tried and he tried. And he came off one boat, and I can always remember it. He was like, "They're taking us." I was like, "They're taking us?" He says, "Aye." I says, "Where are they going?" "Going to Lebanon." I said, "Lebanon?" So there's war torn. I says, "What about the passports?" "Oh, that's all right, they're taking us without passports." I was like, "You're a beauty. We must have been off our nuts." It was a cargo boat. It was taking electrical equipment to Lebanon. The crew were Israelis and Lebanese. The boat, oh, it was a cargo boat, all right, it certainly wasn't a luxury liner. And we had this cabin that hadn't, I don't think it had been slept in for a long, long, long time, or livable. And I can always remember the night, it was a windy night, it was raining, it was windy, and this boat started to leave Limassol docks, and I can remember looking at the porthole. I know it sounds like something of a film, but, well, that's just the way it was. And I can remember as the boat was getting further away from the dock side, I was like, oh my God, there's no turning back now. We're going to Lebanon. So on the way to Lebanon, the cabin was full of cockroaches, I can remember that. And we got toilet paper and we managed to plug up all the holes in the travel across to Lebanon to keep these cockroaches from us. And then we had blankets and we used to, when we went to sleep, we'd wrap blankets around us so the cockroaches couldn't get to us. We did eventually get rid of those cockroaches. And I can remember when we were sailing down the coast of Beirut, from Cyprus, to put you in the picture, see, from Cyprus, when you looked across the water, right, many miles away, you could see the war in Lebanon, believe that or not. You could see the flashes, even though it was so far away. But the first night that we arrived in Lebanon, we were sailing down the coast of Beirut, and it was so, so peaceful. There was nothing. All we seen was silhouettes of tall buildings. And I remember it was this girl who we got speaking to, and who could speak English. She was Lebanese, and for whatever reason she was on that boat and she was going back home to Lebanon. And I remember I got talking to her and I was like, I says, what is happening here? I says, where's the war? There's no war. And she said to me that at this time of night, everything's under curfew. Nobody walks the streets. It's all just army that's on the street. And never really bought too much about it, to be honest. And they ended up docking at this small port called Minia, it was called. And strangely enough, that was the name of the boat. It was Minia. And we docked, it was dark. We docked in this small port, even though it was a cargo boat. We docked in this small port and we were met with tugboats, and these guys got on the tugboat and they were dressed in civilian clothing and they all had beards and machine guns and all that. And I remember I was at the top of the boat and I ran down the stairs and I says to John, his name was, I said, John, these guys have got on the boat and they're in civvy clothes and they've got guns and that. I says, oh no, they've found out that we're army. We're going to kill. We locked ourselves in the cabin, more or less, frightened to come out. We could hear all these guys walking about and things like that. And the night, that first night, they passed, and it was early in the morning. And we were in our cabin, and the noise was, it was mind-blowing. We knew that it was artillery. It was deafening. And we could hear everybody sort of shouting and things like that in the boat and blah, 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 blah. And we ran to the top of the boat. By this time, the captain, who was Lebanese, had went home that night in one of these tugboats. And the guy who was in charge was an Israeli guy. And there was fighting going on. We never knew at that moment in time who was fighting, but where this dock was, to the right-hand side, there was big massive hills. And on that, and on the top of the hills was the Israeli army. And to the left of the port, there was lots of marshland. And on that marshland, we were led to believe it was the Syrian army. And what was happening was they were fighting each other. And we were right in the middle of it. And this Israeli guy who was left in charge had made the decision that we had to go off the boat. We had to go off the boat because in case it was going to get bombed. And that was only a matter of hours being there. And I remember we got off the boat and we were running towards us. Everybody was running. Even people who lived in the village were running. Everybody was just all over the place, and there was cars driving, and it was just kind of mental, and we could hear mortar fire and that coming down, and again it was loud, and children again screaming, and we managed to take a bit of cover. Not that that would have made any difference if a mortar would have hit us, but it's an automatic thing that you do, eh? You know what I mean? You hide. But if a mortar's coming down on top of you, I don't think a wee wall is going to save you. And that's what happened within hours, and I can remember, like, oh no, we need to get out of here. We must. I don't know how. I says, we've served Northern Ireland. We've seen things happening in Northern Ireland. 2 years in Northern Ireland. Here for hours, and we want out. I says, we have to get out. But unknown to us at that time, we weren't to get out. We'd be stuck in Lebanon for 6 weeks. In the same clothes, remember? But no clothes. So it was decided by this guy, this Israeli guy, that we'd all have to get back onto the boat. And he would take the boat out to sea for safety. And this was a cargo boat in quite a small port, and it seemed like hours manoeuvring this boat. It probably wasn't hours, but it was a wee while anyway, at least, you know, it was some time. And I just kept saying, please hurry up, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. Just get out to sea. At least if we're out to sea, then we're safe. And we did get out to sea, but on the way out to sea, we were on the top of the boat. And again, the noise always got to me. Because the noise was nothing that I'd really experienced before. Because I wasn't in an artillery unit in the army. So that was something I hadn't experienced, but although I knew it was artillery fire. And as we were going out to sea, the artillery fire was coming down in the boat no far from us, going into the sea. We never knew if they were, whoever this was, we never knew if they were trying to blow up the boat, but it seemed to be the case that that is exactly what was happening. But I remember I ran down the stairs of this boat and I grabbed a life jacket. And I remember I put it on, and I remember standing with my hands clasped, and I'm praying, and I'm praying, and I'm praying to God. And asking God to save us, and for the boat not to get bombed. And everything was going through my head at this time, because nobody knew we were in Lebanon. Nobody. If we had been killed in Lebanon, even to this day, nobody would ever have known. We would have just been missing somewhere. Maybe they would have got through an inquiry, possibly, but the boat never got out. And what we kept doing was, the captain hadn't been back since the first night that we had arrived, and the guy who was second in command, he kept bringing this cargo boat in and out, because of the war, we couldn't get in to unload it. So we were still on this boat. So we, as our keep, we cleaned the kitchen, the galley and all that. That's what we could do, but they still never knew that we were British soldiers. Oh no, we couldn't tell them that they were British soldiers. As far as they were concerned, we were holidaymakers in Cyprus. And we just decided, through reasons, that we'd come to Lebanon. I mean, two young guys going to Lebanon. That just doesn't sound right, even to the day. It doesn't sound right. It was so strange, because they had some of the weapons that they had, because the crew had weapons as well. And some of the weapons that they had, they didn't seem to have a clue on how to clean them. And me and John, we were taking their weapons off them. And we were cleaning them. They must have been like, in fact, we didn't make an excuse because they never knew the way that we lived in our country. And we said that when we were younger, we were in the Army Cadets and that was the weapons that we used. And that's how we knew how to clean them. Well, that was the only thing that we could really come up with. And in and out, even at times we were sailing down the coast, Beirut again, where all the windies were all blanked off so that nobody could see the boat when we were going down. And eventually we go back into the port of Minia and we decided we'd stay. Well, we never decided, we asked if we could stay on the boat. And they agreed. So, as I say, we carried on cleaning that type of stuff. And then we decided we'd have to make a move because we don't know when we're going to get back to Cyprus. We're going to have to make a move. So that idea came into our heads that we would leave the boat. Right, it's two young British soldiers and we'd head to the British Army Embassy, in Beirut and we'd come clean. We'd come clean and we'd say that we were British soldiers and we were concerned about safety and we needed to get back to Cyprus. We told them that we were AWOL. We would tell them that we were AWOL, things like that. So we left the boat and we run away from the boat. I don't even think it was an hour. Outside this port, we came upon another village. We were the only white people there and we're young and we're walking along the street and we're trying to get bearings on how to get to Beirut and work this out, how we're going to get to Beirut. And everybody was just looking at us. Oh, it was scary. And we knew, we can't go anywhere, we're going to have to go back to that boat. And that's exactly what we done. And the boat was still in port for a good wee while, days, maybe a week or so after that. And these guys who had come on the boat the night before, the very first night, rather, that we had arrived there, these guys dressed in civvies with the guns, during the time that we were there, they were always coming on and off that boat. And then there was one day one of the crew had said to us, "You like to come up the stairs into the, what do you call it, the mess, canteen, whatever you call it, get something to eat." Aye, so we went up and we were sitting having something to eat and all these guys who I'm talking about were there. Right, and it was dead intimidating. Because we kept saying to ourselves all the time, they found it. They found out that we're soldiers, we're going to get killed. That's what's going to happen. We're going to get killed. That we were convinced we were going to get killed. And it was this guy, this lot of guys, who could speak good English. And he turned round and he went like that to us. Would you two like to work for them? Right? And we were like that. Work for them? He was like, aye. He says, work for them. He said, listen, he says, I've known them for years and years and everything's safe, don't worry about it, you'll make plenty of money from it. This is the way the conversation was going that night. And we felt that we were in a position where we couldn't say no, being honest. So we agreed. But at this point, we never knew. We didn't know what plans that they had for us. All we thought was that they'd found out that we were soldiers and were going to kill us, especially when they said that they wanted us to go with them off that boat that night. And we did. The both of us left the boat that night. And I remember when I was getting off the boat, there was a young Lebanese boy. I don't know, it's very strange this. He offered me, he put his hand out to me to offer me something. And as silly as this may sound, it was popcorn. And I took this popcorn in my hand. I was taken in one car and John was taken in another car. And it was dark, as I say, and it was quiet. Remember we're going up these wee streets and what have you, and then the things were coming into my head, and I later found out with John as well, we were definitely going to die. I was sitting in the car saying, that's it. We're going to get killed. And there's a difference between thinking that you're going to die and saying to yourself, I am going to die, and accepting death. I'd been in dangerous situations before, but I'd never accepted that I was going to die. I would say to myself, I might die, but no, and I accepted it. And all I kept saying to myself was, I just hope when they do it, I just want them to put the gun to my head and just end it. That's the way that I wanted it to happen. You know what I mean? So it was quite terrifying. And we go up to this sort of high flat, not a high rise, but maybe six or seven or whatever floors. And I was taken out the car, as John was taken out the other car, and we were taken into this building. And it was dim lights, and I was like that to myself, oh, here we go. Because they're going to take us into a room, it's going to be like something with the movies. So they're going to interrogate us. And I remember walking up and really, really scared. And they opened this door to this apartment. And I couldn't believe what I seen. We were met at the door with this young lady, a beautiful looking young lady. And all we seen was this bright, bright, like penthouse with marble floors and all that. So one minute thinking that I was going to die, I was in paradise, and I couldn't understand. And you know what happened to that popcorn? I let my hand, I later understood as to why this happened. My hand opened, and all the popcorn went all over the floor. And the young lady was doing picking up on her. And I was doing trying to pick it up. And these guys were like, oh, no. I was told that what I was actually doing when that young boy gave me that popcorn, I was grasping onto something. I was that frightened, and my fist was clenched. So when that flat, penthouse, whatever we want to call it, when I seen this, that's how I let go of the popcorn. So they takes us into this flat. So I'm looking at John, and John's looking at me, and we're like, what is going on? What is happening here? He's sitting across from me, and I'm sitting here, and this girl who I'm talking about, the next thing, we'd been in Lebanon for some time, the next thing, there's trolleys coming out, and there was whiskies, and all different whiskies, and there was bowls of fruit, knick-knacks of food and all that, and what is going on? Cigarettes and all the rest of it. And I remember there was this Australian guy who could obviously speak English. He was the main translator for, he could obviously speak Lebanese. And what they wanted us to do, and they promised us that they had done it many, many times before, and because we were British, and because we held British passports, which we never had, right, and they'd done it so many times, they would want us to fly for Beirut to Australia, via London. This Australian guy would be on the flight, but we weren't to talk to him at all. We'd be carrying suitcases full of drugs. We weren't to talk to him at all. We would go through in Australia, we would go through customs, things like that. Once we were through and outside, he then would approach us, but we were not to speak to him, not to look at him during the flight or anything like that. Well, that's when I can remember saying to him, we've not got any passports. Well, shall we say they weren't too happy. So we told them that we never had any passports, and as I say, they never took that very well at all. And where are your passports? Asking us questions. We told them that we'd left them in the hotel apartment that we said we'd been staying in Cyprus, and really try to keep in with them. Really, at this point, try to keep in with them. And I'm saying to them, but when we get back to Cyprus, we'll get our passports and we'll come back and we'll do what you ask us to do. That'll be right. No way would I went back to Lebanon, even for £1 million. They had offered us, once we had handed over these cases, they had offered us £25,000 British sterling at that time. Well, they're probably blaring a lot of rubbish, right? But this is what they offered us, and tickets to go to anywhere in the world that we wanted. That was our payment for doing this. But as I've said, it never materialised.
The following organisations provide information and support for some of the issues raised in this episode. For further details, please look on the Stand Easy website at standeasyproductions.org. Fighting With Pride supports the health and well-being of LGBT+ veterans, service personnel and their families. In particular, those most impacted by the ban on LGBT+ personnel serving in the armed forces prior to January 2000. For more information, visit fightingwithpride.org.uk. Rock to Recovery is a charity for veterans and their families that provides rapid preventative interventions, specific coaching and assistance, including the provision of short and long-term refocusing support for veterans leaving the service with brain injuries and mental health issues attributable to their period of service. To find out more, visit rocktorecovery.co.uk. Combat Stress is a charity for veterans' mental health. They help with mental health problems such as post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety and depression. They provide specialist treatment and support for veterans from every service and conflict, focusing on those with complex mental health issues. You can find more information at combatstress.org.uk.
Veterans First Point is part of NHS Scotland and the Armed Forces Community Covenant. It provides free advice and support for anyone who has served in HM Armed Forces and their families. For more information, visit veteransfirstpoint.org.uk. Colin's story was told by Colin, a Stand Easy participant in October 2020. It was recorded and introduced by myself, Jade Anderson, and edited and produced by Sandy Jamieson. This project was funded by the Community Fund, the Veterans Foundation, the Armed Forces Covenant, and the Northwood Charitable Trust.